мэрии Петра Офицеров сегодня вышли на свободу.
Кандидатами в мэры Москвы стартует 10 августа. С этого дня
за выборами столичного мэра можно будет
следить. Президент Владимира Путина доход в прошлом году составил 5 миллионов 790 тысяч рублей.
Но Путин доволен.
Силовые ведомства России ждут серьезные преобразования.
Nobody expected a quiet summer this year, and nobody expects it to quiet down anytime soon. Russia's traditional cucumber season, when people retire to their dachas and politics takes a breather, is quickly turning into a season of high-stakes intrigue and maneuvering, and change is in the air. As Moscow gears up for its first real mayoral election in a decade in September, a very real succession battle appears underway in the halls of power, with Vladimir Putin's lieutenants jockeying for advantage. And with this, Putin's central role is appearing to be on the wane. But even as clan battles rage behind closed doors, something new is happening to politics. It's going public, as a new generation demands inclusion and the Russian street flexes its muscles. And on that street, one man and his crusade is quickly displacing the amorphous old opposition as the center of gravity in forming an alternative to Putin's rule. And I think we all know who that one man is. And while we're on the subject of Alexei Navalny, another important shift we're seeing in this tumultuous and consequential summer is the rise of liberal nationalism. Its critics call it a contradiction in terms, especially in a multinational state like Russia. Its proponents say it is the only program that can gain majority support. We seem to be hitting one of those critical junctures, one of those crucial inflection points, which often opens the door to change. Hello and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me in Prague is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert on Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Hi there, Brian.
And joining us on the Skype line from London is co-host Kirill Kobrin of RFERL's Russian service and a contributor to the online magazine Politru. Welcome, Kirill.
Hello.
We decided to try something new on the podcast this week. Instead of the usual focus on a single theme in each segment, we've identified four transitions that appear to be in progress right now, four trends. And the first one I want to focus on is the fact that the elite appears to be actively planning for life after Putin. We've done a whole podcast on this at one point in time, but the process is continuing. And it appears to be intensifying. Not only is it continuing, it's intensifying this summer. And as we've discussed in the past, this by definition has served to diminish Putin's standing. Mark, one of the things that really jumped out at me in all the reports of Kremlin infighting over the Navalny verdict last week, the Sobyanin against Bastrykin, the Volodin against the Siloviki, and so on. One important name seemed to be missing in all that, the name of Vladimir Putin. The only time we saw him was when he was sinking in a submarine into the Gulf of Finland. Is Putin still the decider? Or is he losing that role as Sobyanin and Sergei Ivanov and others jockey for position inside the elite to be his designated successor?
Yeah, is Putin sort of becoming the titular head of state, the Queen of England of Russia?
I wouldn't
go that far either. I mean, I think the problem we've always got is that we're still a situation where Kremlin politics is a collection of bulldogs squabbling under a carpet.
Yes.
And therefore, we can see the perturbations of the carpet, but it's hard to know quite what each bulldog is doing. But nonetheless, I mean, definitely Putin definitely has withdrawn himself from the political process at the moment. And I think that the reason for this is...
At least publicly.
Well, I don't even think just that. I mean, I think he clearly has to weigh in on key decisions, but it's hard to see things that as it were, have Putin's stamp. Mm. He approves things,
yeah.
Which is different from initiating.
Which looks like Yeltsin, actually.
Well, yeah.
Late Yeltsin, again.
But I think for very different reasons. I mean, you know, it is not that Putin is incapable for physical or... chemical, stereological reasons. It is more, I think, that the thing about this is that all politics is about the expenditure of resources, whether that's money, people, political capital, or whatever, on decisions that you hope will actually garner you more resources. In other words, it's a series of gambles. Mm-hmm. And the thing about Putin that we've learned is that Putin will precisely descend in a bathysphere. He will wrestle bears with no shirt on, but he doesn't like to gamble. And I think this is what seems to be paralyzing him at the moment, because he doesn't have a sense of what is a good bet. Mm-hmm. Now, the trouble is that, and this is where the sort of the gambling metaphor begins to play itself out, is actually by doing nothing, he is bleeding. He is bleeding power and resource, not at a huge rate. I mean, he can continue to do nothing for quite some time because he has such a reservoir. But the point is, it's a process that accelerates, because precisely the less active he seems, the less dynamic he seems, the less powerful he seems, then the less people listen to him. So I think this is definitely what we're seeing, is that for different reasons, Putin is following the same sort of path as Yeltsin, of actually making himself increasingly irrelevant and making the key issue who will replace this man, rather than how do we get on this man's good side.
Yeah, no, one thing that made me really wonder if he still was, in fact, the decider was that as you looked at the vacillations in the Navalny verdict, the signals that were being sent out before, and then the amazing flip-flop we saw from Thursday to Friday last week, was that either Putin's not the decider or the decider is very indecisive right now.
I think it's the latter. I mean, I really don't think that we should think of him as being incapable of making decisions, in the sense of doesn't have the clout to actually bring it out. Mm-hmm. You know, he can do still pretty much what he wants within the elite. The issue is that he doesn't seem to have the will to use that power. And frankly, that makes it pretty irrelevant if he's got the power or not.
Yeah, and there's, I mean, something else that struck me in all of this was that the Navalny decision, the verdict and what happened afterwards wasn't just about Navalny. By a long shot, it wasn't just about Navalny. A lot of it was about Sobyanin. Sobyanin wanted Navalny in that race, and he got what he wanted, which gives him the chance to win an election, as we've discussed, and become really the most powerful figure within the elite other than Putin, I would argue. I mean, the Moscow mayorship already is the most powerful post within the elite other than the presidency. And if you won that in an election against a strong opponent, in an election that's seen as more or less fair, then he's immediately going to be catapulted into that role. And others who covet that, like Ivanov, aren't very comfortable with this. So we're seeing there's a lot of balls in the air and a lot of maneuvering going on. Kirill, what's your take? Is Putin still the decider, or is he losing it?
The main question for me, does Vladimir Putin prepare to life after Putin? That's the most important thing. Does he think about, his life after being president of Russia? I'm not sure that he's thinking about this. But his role changed dramatically, as I understand, for the last year, especially for the last several months. When we speak now about political situation in today's Russia, we are not thinking about it as a system which consists of various, powers, details, and so on. For me, now political situation, or what we called previously or formerly Putin's regime, now for me it's a collection of random acts or political, economical, but not a system,
So there's no central logic to it. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, yes, yes. The collection of a collection of random acts, Buddhists called karmas, various karmas. Too many karmas and no any nirvana in this system.
I like that.
speaking seriously, how did Putin's role changed for the several last months? He was a keeper. He kept the balance of various political forces, the balance of various details of all this political system. And now I absolutely agree with Mark. Now he is in the situation in which he ought to bet on someone. That is the difference. The very different roles: to be a keeper of a balance, or to bet on something or someone, because the second position is very risky. And secondly, I am again agree with Mark that Putin is not the person who is, you know, who loves to be risky. Yes, to risk. And the third point, let's remember his last, you know, when did this happen? His last, you know, powerful appearance, you know, on public, Putin's appearance. That was during the electoral campaign. That was 1.5 years ago.
Well, his big press conference, he tried to make a big return.
He failed. He failed to do this. I'm speaking about a real success in PR mm-hmm. terms. That was 1.5 years ago. So that's very important. He's still in a very, in a very strange situation. He's still in shadow. But when he was, in shadow in, say, 2005 or 2006 even, he could, appear before the public and to speak something very powerful. Now he can't do this because he doesn't have even the language to speak to the public today. That's very interesting. Political language. How can he describe, Navalny, say,
or something
like
this? He's never said the name Navalny in public once, to my knowledge.
Yes. He prefers to say a word, Viagra than Navalny. That's very important. That's a sort of, political impotence of Putin now. He cannot, even name the names of his enemies, political enemies.
I think he avoids saying his name more than anything. But yeah, I think he's by choice, he doesn't say his name.
Yes, but previously he did this. Mm. He did this. He is known as a person who tries to avoid serious problems or serious questions during his press conferences and so on. But anyway, he had to do this once a year or twice a year and so on. Now he's absolutely mute. And that's very important. That's very interesting.
Now, if we continue, I mean, there's the logic of this. Where do you think this leads, Mark? I mean, because you have a decider who's indecisive at best mm-hmm. right now, at best. Because, again, last week he apparently made a decision, which was kind of first let's lock Navalny up and then let's let him go so we basically get the worst of all possible worlds from the Kremlin's point of view. But that was also a decision in favor of Sobyanin over Ivanov, basically, the two main people vying to be his designated successor right now. You could throw Shoigu into the mix and Rogozin into the mix as well, but I really think right now those two, would you agree, those two look like the key players at this point in time.
They are, though of course it's always dangerous to be the front runner.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, at present, I'd agree with you. But I think this actually speaks to one of the key problems, and it's a problem that Putin has only himself to blame. I mean, this is the great thing. History shows us that authoritarian leaders are usually the engineers of their own downfall.
Mm-hmm.
When Yeltsin was periodically incapacitated, he had people within his system who needed the system to continue. And there were people like Korzhakov, his security chief, who were never going to become president themselves. So in a way, they became the pseudo-Yeltsin
mm-hmm.
and kept things going until the boss was capable of once again...
Sober.
Yeah, well, yeah. But Putin, in part because his system is more mature, in part because he has actually surrounded himself with a selection of people of a particular type... He doesn't really have the same kind of network, a collective stand-in. And at the same time, he's surrounded by men who would be king.
Mm.
So precisely in this case, going back to your question of how far can this go and where does it go, really we have, I think, one of two very diverging routes. Either he continues to be indecisive, or precisely he makes decisions and then flip-flops, and or they're decisions that are clearly being driven by other people, in which case he continues to bleed. And at a certain point, he begins to become irrelevant, and more to the point, everyone else starts jostling even more overtly for who's going to become the next leader. Or else, because he suddenly appreciates that, he goes the other extreme. He decides he needs to do something big and dramatic to try and shore up his power. Because let's face it, I think he's reached the point where small gestures, a particularly good press conference, is not going to swing
it. It's not going to do it, yeah.
And that's the situation where we have things like wars. Again, I mean, I would stress the things like. Mm-hmm. I'm not actually predicting another war right on the horizon. But, I mean, some grand dramatic gesture which could just as easily be a grand dramatic catastrophe.
Right. Now, there's another, and this is a good way to segue into the next process, the next trend that I see going on right now. As Putin appears to wane in his public profile, in his role as the undisputed decider, we have the reemergence of public politics and the recognition by at least part of the elite that they have to engage in public politics. Moscow is having its first mayoral election in a decade, in which the public is actually going to participate. And it looks like it's going to be something approximating a real election. I mean, it's going to be tough for them to convincingly falsify this. Sobyanin wants this for obvious reasons. Sobyanin recognizes that this is to have the capital's public on his side and to say, I won an election in Moscow against Navalny, is a big, big, you know, a weapon in his arsenal as he's jockeys to be the successor. So we have the reemergence of public politics, but this brings a whole new player into the game. And I don't mean Navalny, I mean the public. I mean the public, because Muscovites are going to be able to vote. And they're going to be able to vote for their mayor. And I'm not saying this election is going to be squeaky clean, because no Russian election ever is. In fact, the last free and fair election Russia had, I think, took place during the Soviet Union. It was the election that produced Boris Yeltsin as head of the Russian Soviet Federated Socialist Republic in June of 1991. I don't think there's been a free and fair election since then, really. But this is going to be cleaner than most. It's going to have to, because there's going to be too many eyeballs on it. And the potential for trouble, if it's too blatantly falsified afterwards, is too great. Mm-hmm. Sobyanin could probably win such an election. In all likelihood, Sobyanin could win such an election. But there's an X factor here. I mean, Navalny can do much better than expected. We were debating on Twitter the other day. Mark and I were involved in the debate on Twitter, like, oh, what bar does Navalny have to clear to be, you know, to be a success? I mean, Boris Nemtsov has said if he gets 1 million votes, there's no way they'll be able to put him in prison. And I'm sure these calculations are out there. But Navalny, we don't know what's going to happen in this election. This man's shown an amazing ability in public politics to generate the unexpected. Recall the Duma elections when his call for Moscow, for everybody, but Muscovites really heeded it, to vote for anybody but the party of crooks and thieves, and it worked. So there's a risk involved right now. And so what can you say about the how does the rise of public politics affect all this thing we were just discussing now? The whole jockeying for position over to succeed Putin might be a moot point, might it not?
Well, it might be, but what it means is precisely we have several different tracks. We still have court politics. Mm-hmm. We still have the old style of, you know, this insider against that insider, this institution and so forth. And they are phenomenally powerful. But again, there is the fact of if they ignore what is happening outside their own circles, they will also become either irrelevant or, more to the point, just simply find themselves in an antagonistic relationship with society. But the point is, what we have to realize is, yeah, politics is emerging, and that's a really exciting thing about Russia. And it's something, you know, once again, politics is emerging. I mean, you know, we've been here before. Well, let's see where it goes. But, of course, that's inevitably a very messy process. Mm-hmm. It's not a nice, straightforward, are you for Navalny or are you for Putin?
No, it's not that at all.
And I mean, if we look at the most recent Levada polls, and, okay, Russians as a whole, you know, 65% are still supportive of the regime. 40% say that things are going in the right way. 40% are saying things are going in the wrong way. I mean, there is a lot of sort of generalized discontent. But really, we're seeing politics between factions, politics between institutions, as different institutions are trying to assert their role, politics between different ideas. What kind of a Russia ought there to be? How important is corruption? How important is nationalism, which I know we'll come to later? Those sides of things. And politics as, God bless it, we're going back to the Marxists, as a class-based thing. Mm-hmm. A middle class that feels it has no particular stake in the status quo and trying to articulate that. But what this means is, therefore, there's phenomenally many cross-cutting currents mm-hmm. of politics. And the only thing one can definitely say is that from this incoherent and sort of protean mess, things will emerge. You know, the next generation, the real political parties, the real political players. The question is basically whether or not the existing elite tries to play those games and reach in, or whether it continues to sort of just regard it as something that has to kind of hold outside the Kremlin walls, mm-hmm. and that somehow, as long as you've done that, everything's okay.
Well, yeah, I think you touched on it. I mean, court politics used to be the only game in town. And now court politics has to share it with what I've dubbed the Russian street, but which is pretty, it's turning into the public, the electorate. Kirill, does the emergence of public politics and the when court politics having to share the stage with that, how do you see this affecting the overall state of play?
Politics definitely is turning to some, social classes and so social circles of Russian population. But the most interesting thing is it's a type of politics which is returning. How does it look? And my answer is the main, feature or the main sign of the process of the returning of politics is a hot discussion inside the opposition, either to support Navalny or not. That is the real political discussion. And this discussion is very hot because those who are speaking that we have to close our eyes to on all Navalny's nationalism and so on because he is the only one figure which is opposing Putin. It's not a political message. A political message is an opinion that we have to see what he is proposing to the society. And that is a real political conversation in real political language. Secondly, a second feature or aspect of this, of this process of returning of the politics in Russia or in Moscow is that it's a very strange type of politics without political parties, without all this traditional political machinery and so on. And it's very interesting that formally this political machinery exists. Yeah, we have Duma, we have political or parties and so on. But everything which is happening now in political sense in Moscow or in Russia is happening just outside all these institutions. And that is very interesting and that is very important. And at the same time, that is very dangerous for the political system, for Russian political system. Because if everything is happening just outside a traditional political institutions or political institutions which have to be traditional, in this case, what is the meaning of all these institutions, what they are for and about? That is a very serious blow to the political system which had been built from the end of Soviet era, and I see as very, very serious danger to this political system that in this case, yeah.
Well, in a lot of ways, that's kind of the point. I mean, it's I think it's interesting, and again, we're going to get to Navalny in the second half, but I think it's interesting he hasn't formed a political party, and I think it's actually very telling, and it's actually very relevant. He's not formed a party, but he's formed one hell of a network. He's formed one hell of a social network. There aren't many people who can get 10, well, I don't know if it was 10,000 or how many thousand, but there were a lot of people on the streets of Moscow last week, as we discussed. And that was for one man, and because one man called them out. And that says something. This is something new is emerging here in politics. I don't think, to use the old advertisement, I don't think he needs no stinking party. Because he's got a network. He's got almost 400,000 Twitter followers. And so maybe something new is emerging here. Maybe at some point it will turn into parties again. But I think it's almost happening
parallel with the existing institutions. Mm-hmm. It's almost
how
like
many of his Twitter followers are tractor drivers from Karaganda? I mean, I think the danger is that precisely what this network means is, I mean, we think of networks and we think of them as constantly spreading outwards. I'm not sure how far we're actually seeing breadth being acquired and how far it's just more a consolidation, a thickening of the connections within a particular constituency.
Maybe. We'll see that. Yeah.
And for me, that's I think, one of the key things, because the tipping point is going to be when we see incumbents who know that they're going to be standing for election, particularly in sort of local elections and such like, who actually feel that they need to pander to the street rather than the Kremlin. That in a way that they fear the public vote more than they fear annoying the apparat. Now, maybe in Moscow,
A big test is going to come in September.
But the question, but sort of without party structures, with it still based messianically around one person and his message, and that message still being whatever Navalny says, you know, still essentially being a down with Putin, down with the Kremlin, a negative one. I'm still not sure how far he can actually reach out beyond certain core constituencies. And that's often the job of a party. The job of a party is, you know, to do all kinds of things, including having succession and checks and balances. But it's also to have a machine that will go out and talk to people who didn't know they needed to vote for you until someone comes and knocks on their door and gives them a leaflet.
Well, I guess we're going to see in the next just over a month, because, I mean, really, this is going to be one interesting month between now and September 8th. I mean, I usually take my vacation the first 2 weeks of September. I'm putting it off because for obvious reasons. But I'm like, damn. I don't want to miss any August either, because August is going to be damn interesting. But I think the test about whether this new model, new age, whatever postmodern thingy that Navalny has is going to be able to play this game, because this is going to be the real test in real time. And I'm getting the sense that he sees this as a bit of a dry run. In a lot of ways. There was a telling moment in an interview he did this past week with Ksenia Sobchak on Dosh TV, where he said, you know, there's not going to be an honest election under Putin, and there's going to be more elections. When she was saying, do you really think you can win the Moscow mayorship? And he kind of dodged the question, but he says, look, there's going to be other elections. There's going to be more elections. There's going to be a time we're going to have fair elections. So I think he's seeing this. This is a bit of a dry run, I think, for him. Certainly he wants to get enough votes to make it very difficult for them to put him in jail to keep his own freedom. But I think the goal in this election, I think, and if he were here, he would definitely disagree with me and probably jump down my throat. But I think that he himself knows he's not going to win this election. The goal is to stay alive to fight another day in another election that maybe he'll have a chance to win. I wasn't planning on doing Navalny this week. We did him 2 weeks in a row. I tried to build another theme around this week, but we seem to keep coming back to it. And I think there's a very obvious reason for that, but in a few moments we'll shift our focus from the elites, which we spent all of about 5 minutes on in the first half here, and go to the street and look at two more important transitions that appear to be underway. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. In the studio with me in Prague is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert on Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And joining us from London is co-host Kirill Kobrin of RFRL's Russian service and a contributor to the online magazine Politru. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Myself and many of my colleagues feel that you react very aggressively to any criticism. You aggressively react when journalists ask about your nationalism. Your rhetoric can be pretty rough. Do you think your aggressive tone might scare off part of the liberal electorate?
If there are things I believe in, I will state those things clearly and directly. I'm not trying to appeal to one part of the population or to show that I'm trying to push the right to change their views because they are not liked by the left. I've been talking about these things for many years, and nobody can accuse me of saying one thing yesterday and another today. Okay, sometimes I'm pushy and aggressive. Maybe I even answered some of your questions too aggressively. But I will continue to state my positions, even if people like you will grab their hearts and say, my God, he's so uncompromising.
That was television personality Ksenia Sobchak chastising opposition leader Alexei Navalny for what she called his aggressive tone during an interview on Dosh TV this week. And Sobchak went on to say that this could turn off voters who would otherwise be favorably disposed to him. This illustrates something that's very important that's going on right now. We touched on it last week. I want to touch on it again. What became clear last week as the Navalny saga reached its crescendo was that he is now the center of gravity in the Russian street. He is the undisputed leader of the opposition, even if much of the opposition is deeply uncomfortable with this, as Kirill was alluding to earlier in the podcast. Kirill, what are your thoughts on this? I mean, Navalny has emerged, but as we listen to Ksenia Sobchak, and I think she could have been a stand-in for a lot of people in the traditional opposition. I mean, she was almost channeling things you would expect to hear from anybody, from Nemtsov to Ludmila Alexeyeva or anybody else in the traditional, what we used to call the opposition. You know, this unease is really there. But Navalny is the man right now. I mean, he really is the center of gravity in the elite. It really is all about Navalny on the street right now. Do you agree? And what are your thoughts on that?
Well, first of all, I'd like to answer Ksenia Sobchak. liberal electorate doesn't exist in Russia, first of all.
In Moscow it does.
Yes. But
in Moscow it does.
Okay, it's just few people, just few people. It's not an electorate. It's just a very small, limited group of people.
I'm not sure about that in Moscow, but continue.
So we'll see, The results of the elections, I'll try to play a role of a pessimist.
You play it so well.
Yes, okay. Secondly, I'd like to focus on this deep division, which now is very serious between two parts of Russian or Moscow opposition groups and just opposition. They are discussing if they have to support Navalny during these elections. And the first thing is that one part of this opposition is speaking that we have to support him, as I told you just earlier. We have to support him because he's the man. He's the real man and the real figure which could be oppose Vladimir Putin. But Navalny is not playing now against Vladimir Putin. He is playing now against Sobyanin. That is a mayor elections. That's not a, you know, presidential elections or something like that. It's not, you know, any sort of struggle, personal struggle between Navalny himself and
But this is
Putin
a common
himself.
Tactic. He's painting Sobyanin with the Putin brush. Sobyanin's popular. Look, he's built bike paths in Moscow. People are supposedly... But he's trying to paint him with this brush, which is something you see in American politics. I mean, come on. I mean, we saw Barack Obama try to successfully paint John McCain with the George W. Bush brush. We saw the Republicans run against George McGovern and the hippies for decades. So that's not unusual that he's going to paint Sobyanin with the Putin brush. If I were advising Navalny's campaign, I'd say do it. No?
Yes, but what you are saying about American experience, that was a game inside the limits of a real political system with the real political parties and the real political tradition. And that's why that was, you know, just another one, you know, aspect or side of a very complicated, sophisticated political
You're right,
process.
Kirill. You're right. Sorry
yes.
to interrupt you. You're right. But I'm going on the assumption, and maybe I'll be proven wrong. It won't be the first time. It certainly won't be the last. But I'm going on the assumption that this is going to be a real election. I mean, I really am. And so real campaign tactics and something that struck me about the Navalny campaign is like, you know, they got these little wristbands and the T-shirts. I haven't seen this in Russian elections, right? He is kind of running it like it's some kind of Western campaign. The way he rolled out his campaign, he seems to be playing as if
this were a real election. I think in his heart he knows he's not going to win, but I think he's, again, it's a dry run.
But how far
it's a dry run.
Is he really appropriating what I hesitate to call the worst of the Western political tradition? Yeah, all the glitz, all the little sort of the tactics, the ways you sort of mobilize your workers and this, that, and the other, without still addressing, and I think this is very much sort of speaks to kind of Kirill's point, precisely about, well, what is the substance of this
election?
Well,
no, he's put out a very detailed program.
He's
I've said this once before, and I'll say it again.
And I agree with you. But, I mean, one has to say that programs do not politics make.
But you said, where's the substance? It's in his program that he's talking about. I mean, I hear him talking about it, and I've seen his program. It's posted online. It's printed. It's people have it. His volunteers are handing it out. See, I think this is the Kremlin makes this accusation all the time. They don't have a program. They don't. They just want to criticize. He actually said, "I'm going to address this. I'm going to write a detailed program." Guriev wrote his economic platform. He has an economic platform. He has a plan for Moscow transport. That he outlined actually in the interview with Sobchak. So, I mean, I feel like I'm working for the Navalny campaign here. I'm not. But, I mean, he. The fact of the matter is he does have a very detailed program. But all campaigns are going to have the glitz and the bells and whistles. I mean, campaigns that are successful. Think of any campaign in any country, democratic country, that was successful. It had the bells and the whistles and the armbands and the T-shirts and the baby kissing and what have you. He seems to be putting these things together. Is it going to make him mayor of Moscow? No. Which is why I said this is a dry run. But he seems to be playing as if this is a real campaign. Kirill, you wanted to jump in here because I interrupted you before you finished your remarks.
So the main question is, what is the real aim of Navalny's company? I'm absolutely sure that he's not going to become the next Moscow mayor. He is using this mayor campaign as a one of the very important, very effective tool to become a national political leader.
Exactly, exactly.
Yes, but if we're speaking about a real politics, how can we use a struggle for one of the most important positions in Russian politics and economical and social life just to give it up during your absolutely other political game? So you can't use...
You mean the Moscow mayorship?
Yes, you can't use...
I have an answer to that.
Yes, you can't use a very important for, several millions people thing just as a tool in your, some political game or some political...
You can, if nobody really... I mean, can you think of anybody else who has a chance to beat Sobyanin? I can't, really. I mean, can you think of anybody that can challenge the Kremlin-anointed candidate
now? What is the virtue of beating Sobyanin?
The virtue of beating Sobyanin? If he beats Sobyanin, you know what Navalny said. What happens if you beat Sobyanin? He said Putin's regime turns into a pumpkin.
Precisely, and I think he's right. That's the whole point. It's nothing to do with Moscow. It's nothing to do with Moscow. It's purely... Yeah. I mean, I think... And again, I mean, look, I absolutely understand the political trajectory behind it. And again, if I was advising Navalny, I'd be saying exactly the same things. But we have to acknowledge, as Kirill was saying, that essentially Moscow is simply being used as a tactic.
Of course
there
it is.
I mean, in many ways, if the Kremlin really wanted to mess Navalny up, they'd tell Sobyanin to step down.
Well, no, because then Navalny would have Moscow. And there is no position in Russia, no position, other than the president with such power as the mayor of Moscow, not the prime minister, not the national security advisor, not the defense minister, not the interior minister. If you're the mayor of Moscow, you're essentially the vice president of Russia. You got so much budgetary independence that you're almost untouchable. I mean, the thing harder was to get Lushkov out. They finally got him out after a long time, but he was ready for retirement anyway. But I mean, if he has Moscow, you know what kind of money there is in Moscow? But I don't think that's... I don't think that's what Navalny's game is. I think his game is to chip away at the monolith of this regime and bring it down. For lack of a better word, I think his game is revolution. Okay? And this gets to the true issue of should we trust Navalny or not, which is going on in the Russian opposition and the Russian intelligentsia and, yes, Kirill, the liberal electorate right now. What is going on now is because – I had a very interesting conversation this week with Robert Colson, one of our correspondents, one of our very good correspondents here at RFE, who just wrote an excellent piece about Navalny's nationalism, and we were talking, and he said, you know, we're in this situation right now where Putin has destroyed all the institutions in the country to the point where you almost have to have a revolution in order to build them back up again, to build up the democratic institutions. You can't build democracy within the confines of the Putin system anymore. But in order to do that, to have a revolution based on a personality, you got to really trust that personality. And this is what gets down to why this question of Navalny is so important right now. And this is why all the angst that we're seeing in the Russian intelligentsia, should we trust this man? Because I think they see this. If there's somebody that's going to bring this system down, this is the man. Can we trust him? I mean, the last time, and again, we keep coming back to this comparison, the last time the Russian intelligentsia had this conversation, it was when? It was after Sokurov died and they were wondering if Yeltsin could be trusted, if you remember correctly. This, I think, is what it comes down to. He's playing at a slow-motion revolution. It's not going to be, it's a slow-motion revolution. He loses this election, gets 20 to 30%. They can't put him in jail. Maybe he even wins on appeal because they have no other alternative. He lives to fight another day. He wins a seat in the Moscow Duma. But the whole goal is to chip away at this system, to bring it down, to have another system where you will have free and fair elections, or so he says, or as he says right now. You will have a parliament that means something. You will have political parties that mean something. So I think the game is a little bit longer. Yeah, if they really wanted to screw him up and tell Savianin to stand down, okay, pal, you got Moscow? They're going to hand him Moscow? No way. If he wins it by accident, they're in deep trouble, and I agree with Navalny. If he wins the mayorship, Putin does turn into a pumpkin, as he told Moskovsky Komsomol. It's 2 days before his conviction. Mark, you want to jump in here? I've been shooting my mouth off too much.
I mean, it's fine. I mean, I think that there's a question of, I mean, is Navalny ultimately a sort of a messianic leader? In which case, yes, a lot of these questions about trust become relevant. Or do we accept that he's a politician and therefore he will have umpteen flaws and there will be, you know, very rarely do you find yourself in a position where you can vote for a party or a person with whom you agree 100%. Mm-hmm. Usually it is precisely, it's a choice of...
I've never voted for somebody I agree with 100%.
It's the least worst option, which is, alas, the sort of the best we usually can hope for in democratic politics. Or the other option, and here we're talking, you know, going back to, as we were saying in the last podcast, the last outsider who is sort of a contender for power and a lawyer at that, is he a Leninist? And there is a part of me that actually sees or suggests that Navalny is a Leninist.
Not in the communist sense, but in the sense that,
firstly, you know, going back to this business of his abrasiveness, yeah, I mean, I don't have a problem with that. I think, you know, under other circumstances, you know, I would rather an abrasive personality than an inactive one, which is frankly how the rest of the opposition movement has largely been characterized. But I mean, I do think that Navalny regards himself as having the answers. Or more like to have the answers, which again is a good, strong, solid self-confidence that is what you need. I think he believes that the ultimate purpose of the movement is to precisely support him. He is not a servant of the people. And now, I mean, none of this is criticism. I mean, this is all just simply an observation of this type of politician he is. But I think in that respect, there is an element in him which precisely needs the status quo to get worse. I suppose we're moving from Lenin to Trotsky. But, you know, in that sense that actually, this is why I sort of say, and okay, jokingly, that if they gave him Moscow, it would mess him over. Yes, of course, he'd suddenly acquire massive resources and everything else. But then he'd be in a position where he'd actually have to start doing things. Then it'd be, well, okay, how are you going to apply your new metro policies and such like? At present, his virtue is precisely that the current incumbents are so bloody bad at what they do. And in a way, as long as you've got someone who can creditably and credibly point to these flaws and say, look, this is not the way it should be, it can be different. I mean, really, I think historically, Navalny's big bequest to Russia, if this works out, is not necessarily to be the leader who takes them to this promised land. It's to be the person who brings politics back to Russia. And then maybe it's going to be a next generation of people who are actually going to have all these political discussions and debates.
This is precisely why the bar is so high for Navalny right now. We can't judge. It's hard to judge him just like a politician. And if you watch, and I would recommend anybody interested in this subject to watch Ksenia Sobchak's very fascinating and interesting and informative interview with him, and informative on a number of levels, from his program for Moscow to his temperament, to his nationalism and everything. It was an excellent interview. But for this reason, the bar in Navalny is high, because if he does pull this off, and it's still a damn long shot, and I don't mean the Moscow mayor's election, I mean something a little bigger than that. His task is going to rebuild Russia's democratic institutions. He says that's his intention. He speaks the language of democracy very well. Right now, I'm willing to give him the benefit of the doubt, but the bar is high. And this leads to the last of our four things we want to talk about today, the big bugaboo from his past and present. I mean, his alleged, real or alleged, nationalism. So we'll move now from Navalny to Navalnyism, if you will. And what is this is the hottest topic among the Russian opposition right now. Kirill, last week when I referred to Navalny's nationalism as soft nationalism, you said derisively that soft nationalism is like soft vodka. And that is a direct quote from last week's podcast. Would you care to elaborate on that?
If Navalny is trying to become, and he's actually trying to become, a national leader, and my role today is to agree with Mark, absolutely. And if he's trying to play this role, even the hints about his national senses or, you know, some nationalism and so on is at the same time very dangerous and very stupid, because Russia is a multinational country. Because Russia is not a country of just Russians, yes? If he wants to be trying to be a national leader, he must think about all the citizens of this country. And if he's speaking about that his aim is to restore democratic institutions in this country, but the real federalism, a real, you know, the very idea of Russia as a federal republic, which consists of several, you know, federal subjects.
More than several.
Yes, more than several and so on.
Dozens.
And, yes, and a lot of nations. So that is very dangerous, because first of all, if he's trying to restore democratic institutions just for Russians, or he is trying to restore democratic institutions for Chechnya, or say Ingushetia.
In fairness, he says he is. I mean, this came up in the Sobchak interview, where she said, "What would you do about Chechnya?" And he said, "We have to restore the rule of law and proper democratic institutions there." But that's going to require even more money than we're spending on Chechnya right now. But that money can't go for Kadyrov to build, you know, shrines to himself. It has to go to building up the institution to institution building there. So in fairness, he is talking about these things. And so, I mean, I've always found this interesting contradiction, and I'm wondering if Navalny's going to resolve it. Because if you listen to him speak, in the last months I've listened to him speak a lot, his favorite word is grazhdanstvo, or grazhdanin, civic, citizen, right? Citizenship, some derivative of that word. And but yet, if you listen to his speeches at the Russian March, he does speak the language of a Russian nationalist as well. I'm wondering if he can ever evolve. And I intend to write a blog on this in the coming weeks. This nationalism, if it could evolve into a civic patriotism, which is a very different thing than nationalism. Civic patriotism is pride in your citizenship. And in this case, it would be, as you correctly say, citizenship in a multinational state, which does happen to be overwhelmingly Russian, but it's still a multinational state. When I think of my American patriotism, it's the diversity is one of the things that makes me the most proud. But I am definitely an American patriot, right? Mark, what do you think? Can this nationalism evolve into civic patriotism, which is a very positive force, which is not a destructive force? It's a very constructive force.
Yes, I mean, let's face it, nationalism is one of these words that are often very much in the eye of the beholder. You know, mm-hmm. I am patriotic, you are nationalist, he is a xenophobe.
Right.
And, you know, quite what do any of those things mean? And again, it's a question of, you know, how far they're sort of divisive, how far they're sort of about placing yourself, your own ethnicity above others and things. But I think we also have to acknowledge that there can be a difference between the personal and the political. There are these sort of accounts of Navalny using unfortunate words and referring to people and so forth.
He's apologized for the derisive comments he's made about Georgians.
But nonetheless, he's made them, and I think there's also another case of, I think, an Azeri or whatever.
That's a secondhand account of somebody that worked with him in Yablokha said she heard him saying this. He denies it. I don't know. Since we weren't there, we don't know.
But nonetheless, this is the sort of thing which, again, goes back to this sort of conversation, can we trust this man and so forth. But again, we have to realize that this man is not up for sainthood. He doesn't have to be sort of entirely infallible. Someone can actually have certain sort of deep and regrettable, and let's face it, sort of often culturally rooted prejudices. And yet, as an individual leader, and above all, in terms of the political movement that he creates, can actually be able to transcend that. I think there's no evidence to suggest that Navalny is just spinning a line when he talks about the importance of citizenship and citizens. Mm-hmm. Nor is there any reason to suggest that he is regarding the Russian Federation as really just the Russian Empire, with miscellaneous other minorities sort of cluttering the place up. There are prejudices, but certainly everything political that he's outlined doesn't speak to that. So, I think that it is entirely possible. But the problem here is that the Russian Federation still hasn't really been defined.
Mm-hmm.
Yeltsin failed as a state maker. And therefore, the whole reason why there are so many of these sort of really quite fraught discussions is no one really can agree on quite what being a patriotic Russian federation means.
Right. No. Nobody's built up this concept. Again, civic patriotism. It's a very different thing than nationalism. And this to me is one of the key questions, is if Navalny can square that circle. I've seen different signals. Okay. There was a very interesting debate he was having with a Duma deputy from United Russia. I think it was Isayev, but I can't remember. But I do remember this line from Navalny, because Isayev was assailing Navalny for studying at Yale University. He's like, what did you take out of going to Yale? You went to Yale University after saying that Yale University is one of the best universities in the world, and who would pass up an opportunity to study there? He said, one of the most impressive things I saw at Yale was how many Chinese students there were. That America attracts all of these Chinese students, and this makes America stronger. And this is something we should think about. Now, that doesn't sound like a nationalist to me. Mm-hmm. It doesn't sound like a nationalist to me at all. I think, let's face it, the man's 37 years old. He's working these things out, I think. He's working these things out for himself. Kirill, would you like to jump in here?
I think Navalny's previous nationalist remarks, they were more of ethnic xenophobic nature than of political nationalism, because he was speaking not about any other political nations, Chechens or Georgians and so on. That was a sort of low level xenophobic remarks. Of course, no one is saint in this, in his life and so on. But at the same time, his nationalism, or what we are the thing which we are speaking about as a nationalism, is at the same time is a very serious threat for his future political career. And at the same time, it's a huge political resource.
Right.
Because
exactly.
don't forget that Russian nationalists are very, very strong now in Russia. And
Russians are deeply patriotic. Small p patriotic, but...
Yes, and Russian patriotism or Russian nationalism, which divides the population of Russian Federation into, real Russians and some other people, it's very popular now in Russia. And if Navalny really wants to use this resource, that is the question.
Well, and again, for the third time, I'm going to come back to this. If we've spoken for Godfrey over a year about Navalny as the one figure that can possibly unite the two big wings of the opposition, the nationalist and the liberal wing, right? Well, he's got to do it somehow by blending their value systems. And and this gets to this whole notion of liberal nationalism. Is liberal nationalism possible? Navalny and Anikin had a debate about this online about a year or so ago. It's come up again and again and again. I tend to agree with you, Kirill, that soft nationalism, in the way I understand nationalism, is like soft vodka. But civic patriotism is something that could bridge that gap. Just somebody has to articulate this. Navalny certainly is articulate enough to articulate this. Mark, what do you think? Is liberal nationalism possible, or is this a contradiction in terms?
I mean, I'm inclined to say that most Western democracies practice liberal nationalism.
Or civic patriotism. I think they practice civic patriotism.
No. Actually, I'm willing to go with liberal nationalism. I mean, I think civic patriotism is a very sort of sugar-coated version. I mean, that's, as it were, the ideal. Mm. In practice, democratic countries, nationalism in terms of, you know, playing to either the country as being somehow exceptionalist and having its own special role, or else the predominant ethnic group, it plays a role in politics.
Yeah.
Now, again, in an ideal world, would it be otherwise? Yeah. But the key thing is that, and again, this is going back to Kirill's point, that actually there is a great opportunity. It's not that Navalny needs to get into bed with ultra-nationalist skinheads, even though they might end up supporting him for a whole variety of reasons, but it's that precisely he can speak to a variety, speaking many tongues. I mean, he can speak to Russians as ethnic Russians and say, look, you know, I understand your own particular plight, your own historical trajectory and so forth, and I can, you know, sort of talk to that. But he can also speak to Russian citizens and say, look, you know, we deserve something better. Because I think this is the fascinating thing, and this is what I think speaks to his sort of civic patriotism, is that, you know, particularly of late, a lot of his rhetoric actually is very statesmanlike. But it is, if I'm, you know, talking to the subtext and sense of the word, it's basically saying, you know, your country is being let down by its rulers.
Exactly. We're better than this.
Yeah.
We're better than this.
And
that's a powerful message.
I think it's a terribly powerful one, because it brings exactly together, you know, his anti-corruption roots, you know, a tapping into nationalism,
yeah,
and also actually speaks to the need to reform this country. So in that respect, I mean, I think he has found that base. You know, he'll have to
Russians
fine-tune it.
Russians can do better than this.
Precisely,
this
is, and that's going to be the way he
Russians
brings
it are better than this. This is what he's. It's very. No, a couple of weeks ago, Mark Sutter was saying he's not addressing the fundamental moral bankruptcy of Russia, if you remember. And there is something to be said for that. I mean, I'm wondering if he's going to begin to challenge his electorate to be better. Mm-hmm. It's a tough thing to do when you're running for office to tell people they have to be better. You're supposed to be the one that's going to make it better. But maybe that's a project for a later day. Kirill, last thoughts before? Well, actually, before we do wrap up, there is one thing I wanted to address, and this is Navalny aside, the whole issue of liberal nationalism. Those that promote it now. And, you know, political analysts of the caliber of Andrei Piankovsky are proponents of this now, are saying if we liberals don't take this nationalism away from the retrograde elements, it's going to, you know, patriotism is going to be tainted forever. So this is the sense we have to good people have to take nationalism away from the bad people. Is this a legitimate argument, in your opinion, Kirill?
The question is, what is the thing they are trying to steal? If they are trying to steal, you know, ethnic nationalism from ethnic nationalist agenda from the nationalist, you know, movements in Russia, that's wrong from my point of view.
Yeah, because who wants that?
Yes. If they are trying to steal state nationalism, state nationalist agenda from, you know, Putin and his circle, from Kremlin, that's true. That's good. The difference is between, you know, not liberal or, you know, some other nationalism, but the difference is between ethnic nationalism and not
civic patriotism.
Not civic, but state nationalism. In terms of Russian history and so on, we have to speak about state nationalism. It could be soft. This particular sort of nationalism could be soft, unlike vodka, because It's a long way to go to, you know, a civic society in Russia. So the only one serious value in modern, you know, political discussions now in Russia, the most, you know, popular is state. So if Navalny wants to be, you know, winner in this struggle, he must steal all this, you know, state agenda, including state nationalism.
Mm-hmm. Mark?
Yeah, I mean, because then you've really got a situation in which actually you are speaking to the ethnic nationalists and more or less saying, look, you would be far better within a Russian Federation that is constituted on the following grounds or whatever. They can't directly co-opt ethnic nationalism.
No, and nor
they can't,
should they.
They can't go and say, well, Democrats will kick the snot out of people of different colour much more effectively than others.
No, whatever. Yeah, they don't. I agree
what
with
they,
you.
What they can do, and this is, you know, this is actually how nationalism gets house-trained within modern democratic societies, is by people simply ask, well, look, you know, actually think about how your life will be. Think about what's important, not just in practical terms, but also in sort of, you know, moral and so forth terms, and co-opt it in that respect by basically shifting, as Kirill has said, the basis of ethnic nationalists and making them state nationalists.
Mm-hmm. And so, which turns into pride in institutions, pride in history. Kirill,
there are a lot of things in Russian history, including, you know, a judicial reform under Alexander II, which Russians could be proud of, and that's very important. The question is, what is the matter of this nationalism? You know, the endless wars and invasions and so on, or building a reasonable state,
a better life for your citizens,
yes.
and workable and, institutions.
Yes.
I mean, that's
that
quite enough.
Yes, and that's the real difference, and that's the thing which Navalny and his movement must understand. That's not about wars and, you know, all this stuff. It's all about reforms, building the society, and economic success, and social progress, and cultural gains, and so on.
I think Navalny gets that. Before we wrap up, I'm going to put you both on the spot. We looked at four processes today that are going on. The wither Putin, if you will, as the succession battle continues, the rise of public politics, or the return of public politics, the emergence of Navalny as the central opposition figure, and the phenomenon of liberal nationalism, which we all agree, we hope, will turn into civic patriotism. Taken together, do these four things tell you anything about where we are right now? What does this all come together? And I won't name either of you to put anybody on the spot, but jump in.
Well, okay. I will say again, it emphasizes my view that we are seeing the collapse of Putinism. The key thing is obviously the timetable, because everything collapses eventually. This is why I don't believe that Putin has another presidential term in him.
I don't think he's going to finish this one.
I think he might limp through to the end of that, but I think it's more likely that about a year or so out, he will be prevailed upon to step down and a successor, with the hope of the existing elite being that a successor can essentially sort of start from scratch, blame Putin for everything, but nonetheless maintain the status quo. That will fail too. So that's why, I mean, I think we're certainly talking about the closing years of Putin and Putinism.
It may be a protracted and tumultuous transition period.
It's not, yeah, I mean, you know, you talked about Navalny's crusade. Crusades are never pretty.
Mm-hmm. Kirill?
Several points. First of all, something serious, very serious, will happen this autumn, I think, on the same level as Putin's decision to run for a third term 2 years ago. Something will happen. I'm not sure that that will be, you know, some new war or something like this, but the political scenery will change dramatically this autumn. Secondly, I think we are in the very beginning of a long process of the collapse of Putin's regime. That will be a very long way. The main task of, you know, Navalny or some other people or some, you know, some reasonable people from Kremlin, inside Kremlin and so on, to make this process not disastrous. That is the main thing.
No, I agree with both of you. We're into endgame right now.
And I think the timetable, I agree with you, Kirill, something's going to start this autumn. But then I think the next flashpoint's the Sochi Olympics, basically. So much money has been spent on that thing. So much money has been stolen. Something as banal as the Russian national team not winning enough medals can really be something that can – what do we spent all this money for what? You know, so I mean I think the timetable I think I'm looking at right now is from the fall, and I could be wrong. I mean I wouldn't be the first and won't be the last time. But I think that's the timetable between this autumn and the 2014 Sochi Olympics. I think we're going to see some changes. What emerges out of that is anybody's guess. I think Navalny's here to stay. And as I've said a million times, I'm waiting for the day when, metaphorically speaking, Alexei meets Alexei, meaning when the reasonable elements of the elite in Navalny inevitably, I think, at some point, cut a deal. Because, Mark, that's Putin stepping aside thing you were talking about, I think that's going to have to bring the street into it. I don't think they're going to be able to do that without the street unless they're really...
Not successful. Successfully.
I think
if we they couldn't successfully rule out them thinking yeah. that they can do it without
If they do it successfully, it'll be with the street, which will be a Polish-style roundtable mm-hmm. transition. If not, they're going to blow it. And then we're in for, God, a period of instability and God knows what. So, and unfortunately, that is all we have time for today. But none of this is going away anytime soon. I would like to remind you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me in Prague for the last time in a while has been Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russian security services, and author of the blog In Moscow's Shadows. Mark, I hope you have a pleasant trip back to New York. It's been great to have you here in Prague over the summer.
Thank you, likewise.
And joining us from London has been co-host Kirill Kobrin of RFERL's Russian service and a contributor to the online magazine Politru. Thanks for the great discussion, gentlemen.
My pleasure.
I'd also like to thank our very well-rested producer, Tanya Kancheva, who is finally back from Croatia, where she enjoyed two fabulous weeks free from me. I'd also like to thank my indispensable colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally indispensable Twitter feed Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week, and now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.